breaking ball and a call. Strike three. Third strikeout for Zach.
He's going to just watch it go. A grand slam for Bryson Stott.
And there's a high fly ball. Deep right field. Harper watches it fly.
From WHYY, this is your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. I'm Justin Clue of Baseball Prospectus. The Phillies did not celebrate or acknowledge an anniversary this past week, which was the 10-year anniversary of the White Towel Game, the White Flag Game, whatever you call it. We can all see the image in our heads of former Phillies pitching coach Bob McClure waving a white towel to get the bullpen's attention because the phone was off the hook in what looked like the purest form of surrender I have ever seen on a baseball diamond, because the Phillies were getting crushed by the Orioles and wound up losing 19-3. The Orioles scored 12 runs in the first three innings that night on June 16th, 2015. They outhit the Phillies 17-6 and generally reminded the truly sick people in the stands that Ryan Sandberg's Phillies of 2015 were just not there yet. Our friend from The Good Fight, writer Joe Ettinger, had a piece up this week commemorating that milestone of sad Phillies lore, and we now welcome here to talk about it. Joe, thanks for joining us on Hittin' Season.
Thanks for having me.
First, before we dive into that topic, I do want to talk a little bit about the Mets, who the Phillies are going to face this weekend. The Phillies are playing a bit better of late than the NL East's first place team, but what a time for these two to play each other in South Philly this weekend, with first place being on the line. According to the media, the Mets having lost four games in a row, four entire baseball games, including a real heartbreaker to the Braves on Tuesday night, has them in, quote, the worst state they've been all year.
You hate to see it.
It's tough. That's tough to hear, tough to watch. Tyler McGill is hurt. Kodai Senga is hurt. Frankie Montas' rehab is not going well. Are the Phillies catching the Mets at just the right time?
Maybe. I just need to see the Phillies play the Mets well. I don't want to say it feels like they're in their heads at this point, but that series earlier this year was rough, and they only led for, I think it was one inning across three games. So I think it would be huge for them to win this series just to get that feeling of, oh, wait, we can beat this team. And the Mets are kind of going through what a lot of us thought was going to happen before the season, was that, yeah, their lineup's good, but their pitching was always suspect. And now it seems like that bill's catching up to them right now.
Yes. David Peterson has been a revelation this year for sure. That's got to be said. But other than that, I think, yeah, I mean, it would have been crazy if 2 years in a row the Mets kind of just went with this Rima printer paper for a starting rotation, and it just, like, totally worked. No notes, no problems, just kind of like is something cool and good for the Mets. So, yeah, I would have been surprised if they made it through a whole other campaign with that being the case. So this is, I think you're right. I think this is a little bit of the bill coming due, but one of the Mets' weaknesses is also base running. They're not good at it. And Juan Soto has not made them better at it. Last night, I guess you could say on Tuesday night, you can blame the umpire. Juan Soto certainly was, where he got tagged up. He tried to tag up on a ball that Ronald Acuna made an incredible catch at the fence, and Soto was unsure if it had been caught or not, and he said later he was waiting for the umpire to make the call, and the umpire was just very slow to make the call, and he wound up getting doubled up at first base. But, I mean, this is part of a longer track record of Soto things. He is compared to Ted Williams because he is that good of a player, but then he's got little hiccups like that. There's also grumbling about Carlos Mendoza's decisions as a manager. And, oh, yeah, there's kind of a gaping hole at third base. As Jeff Passan writes, considering the Mets have multiple options at third base, the quest for an internal solution isn't banking on the fortunes of a single player. It could be Mark Vientos, the postseason star last year, who's set to begin a rehab assignment next week after a disappointing start to the season. It could be Brett Beatty, who has shown plenty of power, but still sports a .267 on base percentage. It could be Ronnie Mauricio, the rookie whose pop and allergy to getting on base is similar to Beatty's. Joe, are the cracks starting to show in the Mets' little fun time underdog express?
Man, I sure wish. But they're not going to go away. The lineup outside
I want them to,
third,
though.
Yeah, I know. Don't we all? They're still going to be in this thing till the end, but I do think they were never going to run away with this division. I don't think anybody is running away with this division.
No.
This is coming down to the wire. And it's going to be a two-team race. As much as we all think the Braves have a run in them, that run might just be to get back to 500 at this point.
Yeah, I don't think that anymore. I think the Braves are done.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I think they're close to cooked. I'm not ruling them totally out yet, but it's getting real rough down there. So I think you can just focus on a two-team race, and I think it's just going to go back and forth the rest of the way. Like once, if the Mets right now seem to be like they're hitting a bit of a patch like the Phillies were in 2 weeks ago, where just nothing was going right. And I think that's just going to cycle back and forth till the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to make a lot out of a 4-game losing streak, and the loss on Tuesday was particularly enjoyable for anybody who is rooting against the Mets. But it's kind of like, call me when they've lost 10 to 12, because that was a much, much rougher patch that the Phillies went through than anything the Mets have gone through this year. Like, if this is the worst part of their season, as some of their beat writers are characterizing it, then they're having a very, very good season. And yeah, I'm with you. They're not going anywhere. It's just, it's more like I'm encouraged by seeing them fail finally. And when you got to hope that that's a crack that starts splintering a little more. Cause you're right. The last two times these teams have played each other, the Mets have kind of run the table, and I would like to see a change in that trend.
For sure. And I do think that it's important to note, even when the Phillies were horrendous a couple weeks ago, and like you said, lost 10 of 12, they're right back to within 2 games.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I think the furthest they got back was either 5 or 5.5. So even when one of these teams goes on a skid like that, it's really not going to be over.
Yeah. So I think your ultimate conclusion that nobody's running away with this division is probably right. Well, having listed the Mets' weaknesses, how can the Phillies take advantage of them? Or a better question, will they? Tell us the future, Joe. I'm very tired.
I just looked at the rotation for this weekend. They do have Wheeler going. Mm-hmm. That certainly helps.
I like when Wheeler goes against the Mets because he has that extra little mental dagger, at least for their fans, knowing that he's been turned back against them and being used against them. Yeah, I love that. But yeah, then you got Mick Abel and Jesus Luzardo, which, you know, it's not the worst by any stretch, but it's like,
Sure. I've said about Mick Abel recently, it feels like he's walking a tightrope at the moment, and he's due for a real welcome to the bigs kid game where he just gets clobbered in like 2 innings because like those hanging curveballs he's getting away with, he just doesn't get away with anymore. Not saying that, you know, he's going to be terrible. It's just that he's due for a real, like, real rough start in the near future, I believe.
He's a young pitcher who's pitched well and looked good a couple of times, but also, you know, gives up the long ball, you know, Aaron Nola, Christopher Sanchez style. When your weakness is I give up home runs, that just feels like a bigger weakness than, sometimes the umpire is not giving me the outside corner. It's just, you know, or like Jesus Luzardo, oops, I was tipping my pitches so badly that I gave up 20 earned runs in 2 games. Like, that's a heck of a tip there, buddy. But okay, cool. But with him, Luzardo, I was very, you know, encouraged by his first start after those two disastrous starts. And then his last start was, you know, a little different, but not as, I think it landed between the utter dominance we saw from him earlier and the utter decimation that we saw in those two horrible games that he had. But at the end of the day, I guess my concern with Luzardo is now my worry is I don't know who's coming out to pitch when he comes out to pitch, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that I totally understand that. And my biggest worry is that he's already blown past his innings from last year.
Yeah.
He was never considered durable to begin with. And I looked it up. He threw 4 starts straight of 100 pitches a few weeks with his, not this start, but the last start. It was the first time he's ever done it more than 2 starts in a row. So I think there's going to come a point this year where he has to, quote unquote, go on the injured list just for them to rest him. Or maybe he's the guy that ends up in the bullpen when Painter's here. Who knows?
Yeah, very possible. I could totally see that too. Yeah. Well, it'll be a fun weekend, certainly in South Philadelphia, as the Mets come to town and with first place on the line. Like this is gonna be a test, and I think the Phillies are ready for this test again. You know, it's like trying to get their learner's permit. You know, they failed real bad in October. They came back, failed again, did not study, too demoralized. This time, hopefully, they thumbed through the manual a little bit. You know, put a little pressure on themselves, and they have been playing better. They have been playing much better. than the 10-12 the losing 10-12 stretch that we were talking about. So I think they're up for it. I think they're more up for it than they were for the last time these two teams played each other. So we'll have to see. I just, you know, I feel like it's going to be a hot weekend. Let's just say that. And if you find yourself drawn to the ballpark, I will remind you that the Hitten season tailgate will begin in the afternoon on Saturday before the Mets and Phillies game. 7:17 start. It's one of those weird starts. It's around 7 o'clock start. We'll be out in Jetro lot. So come say hello if you're around and feel like meeting some of your heroes. I believe the saying is you should always do that. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the real meat of the issue here, which is a horrible game that was played 10 years ago.
Yes.
Joe, as I said, had an article up on The Good Fight this week commemorating the 10-year anniversary of the White Flag game that I described earlier. And you know, there's just something about this game, Joe, because you mentioned in the article that I, too, while at The Good Fight, wrote an article about this game. I had used the milestone of 1,000 days after it had happened. You waited 10 years, which is, I think, a better amount of time. But as soon as it was happening, I was like, I got to write about this game. And it's just, do you feel as I do, and I think many do, that from that whole rebuild era, which, you know, has probably been compressed in our minds, and, you know, you could probably even look back on it with even like a little bit of nostalgia in a weird way. But like that game stands out as pretty much the absolute rock bottom moment. I feel like other people could dig up other games before and after that maybe you could make an argument for, but ultimately that game feels like rock bottom. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. That image of the White Flag is what we're all going to remember. We remember it 10 years, another 15 years, 20 years, whatever. Whenever we think of this rebuild, we're going to think of that moment. There's just no way about it. It just so perfectly encapsulates everything that was that team.
Yeah, it's the collective disaster with a million pieces. Because you're right, the image of him waving the flag, he's literally waving a white flag. Like, that alone kind of makes everything stand apart. But when you just look at all the different aspects of a terrible baseball game / team that went into that, where Jerome Williams, he got hurt in like the first inning. And left the game after 2/3 of an inning, I'm pretty sure. Or he at least, there's an image of him like grabbing his leg and screaming. Chase Utley screaming at Bob McClure, something he never did publicly, never would get that upset openly, certainly at like a coach or something when he knew cameras were rolling. A position player pitching. That's never a good sign, but at least, you know, it's sometimes a tepid form of entertainment when your team is definitely going to lose. But in this case, it was just more thrown onto the pile. And then that feeds into the overall, you know, what everybody remembers most, which is that the bullpen, they couldn't contact because the phone was off the hook. And that's why Bob McClure was waving the white towel. The Orioles scored like 12 runs in the first three innings. I mean, the game was lost from moment one. And it was just an absolute terrible experience for anybody to just sit there and watch, whether you're at home or in the ballpark. Do you feel like there's any value in looking back on that era, or are we all just a bunch of sickos?
I mean, we're definitely all sickos. But the reason why we're doing this 10-year retrospective on the 2015 team at The Good Fight, and I was so looking forward and excited to write about this game, because sometimes when the current team is struggling and then we all get frustrated, I literally just flash back to that picture of the white flag and go, well, it could always be worse. It could be so much worse. And it's really a good way to keep everything in perspective. Like, sure, it might be World Series or bust, but this team's at least going to probably make the playoffs. And you could literally be watching a phone off the hook, the manager get berated by one of his fielders on the field, and a position player throwing literally double the amount of pitches as the starting pitcher. I looked at it, I'm like, this can't possibly be right. And like, I had to look at it like three times.
Well, do you feel like, how much do you, and this is just a guess, we have no idea, but Ryan Sandberg quits a week later, which I think is a forgotten aspect of this. It's only 7 days after this game takes place that Ryan Sandberg's like, you know what, I'm out. And famously doesn't even really tell the players that he's planning to quit. They kind of just find out when he announces that he's quitting. How much does this specific baseball game, like, give a percentage, go into his decision to a week later just kind of be like, yeah, I don't know why, but I'm out?
I think it's close to 100%. I was even thinking, you can. It's almost like watching a manager lose the team in real time. And a thing like when I was going back and looking at some of the videos for this, when they're trying to get a hold of the bullpen, he's talking to McClure. And he looks, like, really angry, where it's almost like Sandberg is upset that, like, well, yes, this is what we're going to do. Why aren't you doing it yet? Kind of thing. And it's like, he has no idea what's going on. Like, he has absolutely no idea what to do right now. And he's annoyed that no one else does, and he just doesn't want to be here anymore.
Poor Bob McClure. He was given a lot of credit, and he deserved it for he was the one that really did wonders for Zach Greinke, I'm pretty sure, in Kansas City. And people would hold that up as like, oh, yeah, it's a great pitching coach. And, you know, he probably was a great pitching coach. But, boy, the only thing his name will be remembered for in Philadelphia ever will be for this unfortunate circumstance. I've been talking about this current team, you know, since, well, anytime they've struggled. You kind of think, okay, well, is this team, are they going to figure it out? Are they going to get to the postseason? Is this a postseason era, or is it just like, was it just a blip, or, you know, what's going to happen next? And I keep talking about how I think the goal of this era, of the Dave Dombrowski era and everything, is not just to go back to the postseason, it's to elevate the franchise wholesale and prevent like a 10-year gap between playoff appearances. The idea being that, okay, it's going to be like 1 to 3 years between playoff eras, perhaps, maybe like, you know, let's say 5 at the most. The point being that like the Phillies are better equipped and also just have a more interest in winning and being a franchise that is known for winning and just kind of changing everything like at the core of the team. So do you feel like this kind of game that we experienced on June 16th, 2015, that truly was rock bottom for a team that was in a rebuild that wasn't working? Also, that's an aspect of it. We got very little out of this rebuild, and they eventually just flipped the table over and were like, let's just sign a bunch of cool free agents. And here we are. But still, do you feel like this is a game that like the next generation is going to experience as well? Or am I right in saying that the goal of the Phillies is to have elevated the franchise to avoid scraping rock bottom like this?
No, I totally agree with what you're saying in that obviously the ceiling with the Dombrowski era is to win a World Series or World Series. But the floor has been to just raise the standing of the franchise. And like it's only been 10 years since this moment, and look at how far they've come. And of course, I know there's still problems. They still haven't brought a championship home. They still have their own issues, but I couldn't imagine this happening again right now. And then I even went and you look at the press conference after Sandberg quit. Ruben Amaro looked like he literally just came back from like a pool or something, because it took everybody by surprise. And he so clearly borrowed a jacket from somebody. It was not his. And he just borrowed a jacket that did not fit him. And they had to hurry up and throw together a press conference. The organization as a whole was just so in the dark and in the gutter at that moment to where like you even look now, they're actually good at developing pitching. Like they are objectively one of the better teams in the league at developing starting pitching. Their hitting still has, you know, ways to go, but back then they were throwing the likes of Jerome Williams and Chad Billingsley out there and hoping for not disasters.
I'm always like, which one did they have, Charlie Morton or Chad Billingsley? And the answer is both.
Trick question is both.
They had them both. Yeah, wild. A listener wrote in once and told us a story. They said either their parents or their grandparents lived in the same apartment or the same building as Andy McPhail during this time. And their parents or grandparents were leaving to come down to a Phillies game. And it was, I don't remember what series it was, but it was a big series. It seemed like it would be an important series. And they ran into McPhail in like the hallway, and he was like just dressed in like vacation clothes, clearly on his way out of town, like just not interested. Yeah,
I have for some reason a very similar story. I went to a game during this era. I couldn't tell you what year it was. They all blended together, but I was given Hall of Fame Club tickets, and it was after the game. I was there with my dad, and we were walking out through the Hall of Fame Club. And this door opens, and this guy kind of like bumps into me. He's like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, oh, no, it's cool. I took another step. I turned around. I'm like, that's Matt Klentak. I'm like, why is he walking? What is he doing? And he kind of just shuffled off at like a rat who just got seen by somebody into like the fold. And I'm like, That's the general manager of this baseball team.
He just he climbs through like a jagged hole in the side of the wall, just disappears into the infrastructure of the building. Hey, you got an apology from Matt Klentak. That's pretty good. Not a lot of Phillies fans can say that. Although a lot of people have gone back and retroactively said, well, he signed Wheeler and he did, so you do got to give him credit. But when you oversee an era...
I give him credit for Wheeler. Harper's Middleton.
Yeah.
He doesn't get credit for that
Klentak wanted Machado, I'm pretty sure. That was the narrative back then. But
He gets credit for Wheeler.
Yeah. Well, regardless, that time is over. And at some point, that game that the Phillies lost 19-3 to the Orioles also ended. And I just want to add one more thing. And that on June 16th, 2016, a year later to the day from the white flag game, the Phillies once again got their butts kicked by an AL East team. This time the Blue Jays. They lost 13-2 on the 1 year anniversary of that game. It was a game with a lot of the same energy. They were out hit 17-5 against the Orioles. They were out hit 17-6. They committed four errors in the field. They got nailed by Jay Happ, who was starting for the Blue Jays. And it was guess who? And Aaron Nola starred. also starring Colton Murray, David Hernandez, Andrew Bailey, and Genmar Gomez. A real murderer's row of a bullpen.
But before we move, I would be remiss because this is something that article I wrote, it was like 1,600 words. I wrote way more than I wanted to. I just couldn't stop because I just couldn't believe what I was looking up and remembering again. But a thing that I think we all forgot, and I saw it in my research, but I didn't have time to put it in there. Justin DeFreitas got ejected in that game.
Oh, my gosh.
Because apparently he decided to – he gave up a home run, and then the next pitch he, threw inside and got ejected. And when he was asked about it, he's like, you saw what happened. And that's all he left. And I'm like, buddy, you're down by a billion runs. What are you doing? It's a real subplot that I think we all completely forgot.
Oh man, that's what I'm talking about. That game is full of subplots. It has a through line. It has a perfect narrative, and this is why it's so easy to write about, because there's just so much going on in that game. And at this point, 10 years removed, it's all so comical. So I think it is healthy to be able to look back at those games, picture ourselves being 10 years younger, and think, you know what? At least that's not the case anymore. Talking about the Phillies, not us being 10 years younger. But still, we are not there anymore. And hopefully, if this franchise keeps moving in the direction it's moving in, it will be a long time before the Phillies sink that low again. I hear myself saying it, and I'm knocking on my desk. Everyone relax. Yeah. Joe, thanks for joining us on Hittin' Season.
Thanks again for having me. It's a blast.
Well, if you're like me, people are constantly asking you, why are you doing this? In regards to watching the Phillies, I mean. Sometimes it's a tough question to answer. And when this team gets you down, as they can sometimes, it can be healthy to turn to other entertainment outlets to get a baseball fix. I haven't played every baseball video game ever, but I have played a few, and so I never like to miss a chance to talk about the deeply obsolete technology of my youth. But how obsolete can something be if you still get enjoyment out of it? Derek Bain is the author of 5 baseball books and co-chair of the Saber Games and Simulations Committee. John Racanelli is the membership director for Saber's Chicago chapter, founder and co-chair of the Saber Baseball Landmarks Research Committee, and a regular contributor to the Saber Baseball Cards Research Committee blog. Together, they co-authored Hardball Retro's Compendium of Baseball Video Games and Electronic Handhelds, which was one of the winners of a 2025 Sporting News Saber Baseball Research Award. In this collection, Derek and John give you the story behind baseball dice games, baseball tabletop games, baseball electronic games, baseball video games, and baseball games that'll just play themselves if you pick the right menu options. Derek and John, thank you for joining us on Hittin' Season.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about baseball games any time of day.
Well, First two questions I have are for both of you. I just feel like I got to ask to start off. How does a project like this come together? I imagine at least one, if not both of you, played at least some of these games growing up and have overlapping passions for baseball and retro video games. Or is there more to it than that?
From my perspective, I've been playing the console and computer baseball video games probably since the early to mid 1980s. So again, while I haven't played every single one that's listed in the book, I've played quite a few of them. And I wanted a place where I could, you know, look up each of these games, kind of, you know, dive back into my youth and you know, get quotes from some reviews from back in the day, get comments from current baseball gaming enthusiasts, and just kind of share. I know it's a pretty niche subject, but it's one that I'm pretty passionate about. So I'm more of a computer baseball simulation guy than, you know, the hand-eye coordination, the arcade type style gaming, but played a little of everything. So John, you can go ahead and share your thoughts on the I guess on the handheld side of things.
Yeah, I grew up in the late 70s, early 80s. I got addicted to Atari. I played Home Run and Super Action Baseball and Pete Rose Baseball, and then went to the NES, and then I went and played, I don't know how many thousands of hours of RBI baseball with my buddies in high school. And at the same time, I was also into the handheld games and got to a point when I got married in the late 90s that I just started kind of reliving my youth. I started buying them on eBay when eBay was kind of a new thing and just built up a little bit of a collection. I love playing the Entex baseball. There is a Parker Brothers talking baseball game that is an awful lot of fun to play. And I spent countless hours under my comforter in my bed after I should have been sleeping playing Entex baseball. I've told the story before about a trip we took down to Disney World in the car, five of us in a sedan, and my dad threatening to throw the thing out the window if I didn't turn it off because of all the beeps and boops that it made. it was a big passion of mine. And what I really like is you've mentioned, you know, SABRE, the Society for American Baseball Research. Derek and I met at the convention that was a few years ago in Chicago. And he had a table set up where he was showing off some of the computer-based simulation games. We kind of connected beforehand, and I brought, because I'm in the Chicago area, I brought a bunch of my games to display at the table. People would pick them up and play them and ask questions and reminisce about, you know, playing them when they were a kid. And it just was a lot of fun. And it's just kind of one of those things where if you are into SABRE, you're going to find other people that enjoy baseball just the same way you did, and Derek and I hit it off immediately.
I'm in deep enough that when you refer to it as a niche subject, I'm like, no, it's not everybody's into it. I'm like, nope, that's not true. That's just how deep into it I am. That I'm just like, yeah, no, there's universal appeal to having played like these older games. And my personal history in this subgenre is I played a lot of Bases Loaded, the original Bases Loaded for the NES. I played All-Star Baseball 2000 for the N64. I had Hardball 5 for PC, which always cracks me up because looking back, they got the rights to use, they had like the MLBPA, the Players Association rights, but they didn't have MLB rights. So they could use actual players, but not actual teams. And they also had a like robot Al Michaels voice doing all the broadcasting, which going back and watching clips from that game is like, yeah, okay, we've come a long way. But my dad also introduced me to APBA baseball, which he had played, the board game with all the dice that he grew up playing, and he introduced that to me. So we played that a lot when I was a kid. So you kind of referenced this already, but I did want to ask, what percentage of the games did each of you that like you wound up covering in the compendium, did you actually play and experience growing up, and how much research involved actually playing those games as well?
Well, you can put research in quotes, right? Because, you know, playing video games and, you know, telling someone that it's research, you know, you might get some funny looks. I played quite a few of them growing up. Again, not every game because back in the day, I didn't have every system. Although, you know, you had enough friends and classmates throughout the neighborhood where somebody had an Atari and somebody had an Intellivision, somebody had a ColecoVision. And fast forward a few years, somebody had a, you know, a Nintendo, an NES, somebody had a Sega Genesis. So you were, you know, if you were lucky, you were able to play a lot of the games. I personally, I had a Intellivision, got that in 1981, got a Commodore 64 in 1983, and then an Apple II, I believe, around 1986. And then I finally graduated to a PC clone, probably somewhere in 92, 93, somewhere around there. So, again, I had quite a few of these titles. I started following baseball around 1983, 84. So did I play every one of these games, either growing up or even doing research for the book? I can't say I've played every single one, but I think we have a good cross-section of either reviews or commentary from folks that have played them. You know, a good cross-section of responses in that respect.
Yeah, and from the handheld game system, everybody I think probably that I knew had the Mattel. A lot of people had the Entex. A lot of people had the Coleco head-to-head. But when I started kind of looking and collecting these, you know, all those years ago, I was just flabbergasted at how many different games there were. They were all very similar in the LED layout of the field and how the controls worked. But when Derek and I started talking about doing the book, it gave me an excuse to go into my closet and grab all of these, open all these boxes where I have these games kind of tucked away. I had to go out. I had to buy a whole slew of C batteries because I didn't have any on hand. I had to buy a bunch of 9-volt batteries. I didn't have any on hand. But going through and kind of playing each one of them in order to talk about each one of them was an awful lot of fun. And I think a huge part of the book, regardless of what games you might have played as a kid, what games you might have seen other people playing, the nostalgia is just such a big part of growing up. I just think of not only playing Atari or ColecoVision or NES, Super Nintendo, but collecting baseball cards, playing wiffle ball in the yard with my buddies, that kind of stuff. And I think this just all goes hand in hand for people of a certain age. So I just got the biggest thrill out of going back through all these games. And then once the book was done, flipping through it and seeing all of the other stuff, the console stuff that I never knew about or had forgotten about. You know, there's people that love Baseball Stars for NES, but that was never something that was in my, you know, my area. Nobody ever played it, but people are very big into that game. So it's really cool to see what people enjoyed as kids. And, you know, Derek did a great job asking the questions of people in the survey to find out what they were into and what they liked.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting aspect of it that I feel like you would go over to, as a kid, you'd go over to a friend's house, and a lot of my friends were into baseball, so they all had baseball video games, but it seems like everybody had a different one at their house, and you kind of had to like get the hang of a different baseball game than the one you were used to playing, which is kind of a lost element. And John, specifically, in reviewing the older handheld games that that you researched, you mentioned how there are dozens more that you don't get to, but each seems to have a gimmick or a mechanic that was an attempt to set itself apart from the others. And while they didn't always, you know, work or you know, at least work in the way that the developer maybe intended them to, do you feel like that uniqueness or that attempt at uniqueness is kind of a lost element in gaming in general?
Yeah, obviously, when you're making a game that's based on a real game, you need to try and differentiate yourself. And there was all kinds of different things, and you could see the progression of the technology a little bit where, you know, I keep coming back to the Entex baseball game. That is one of my favorites of all time. I played a ton of that as a kid. The original game would keep track of the runs scored during the half inning, but once you hit the change batter button, that disappeared, and there was no scoreboard. So it literally came with packets of paper scorecards that you would use when you're playing your friends to keep score. The next version that came out, you know, the Entex 2, oh, now it's going to keep score. But then there was different other versions of games where you could steal, you could bunt, you could switch out your players for a pinch hitter, and that pinch hitter would have a certain set of statistics that would make it easier for the computer player to, you know, get a hit, or you could change your pitchers. And it was that innovation. And looking back at these games, obviously the technology is of its time, but looking back at it, you could tell that it was expensive for the time, but it was a lot of fun. It took a lot of imagination, but they still, even in the late 70s, early 80s, were trying to one-up each other by putting features in the games that nobody else had.
You've talked about, even as basic as some of these games were, they still were educational about baseball and teach users more about the sport. Maybe not even on purpose, but like that was an effect that they would have. So how effectively do you feel someone could someone not familiar with baseball learn the sport by playing one of these older handheld games? Was there one that was perhaps like a better tutorial than the others?
Yeah, I would say the one that I would believe probably would teach you the most was the Parker Brothers Starting Lineup Talking Baseball. That came out in the late 80s. It came with a set of baseball cards that had statistics on the back of them. You would put into the game an actual lineup of either you know all-stars from either the AL or NL, or the teams that would come on cartridges. So at the time the game was produced, there was 26 teams in Major League Baseball. They had a lineup cartridge for every single team, and you could play, literally, you could pitch Walter Johnson against Kirby Puckett or something, you know. In each of the games that you played, there was an announcer that would say, here's the pitch. The pitches would come into a square set of LEDs where you're trying to guess where it's going to be location-wise, not only just trying to time it. And it really kind of, if you went through the manual and you started playing some games, even if you didn't know anything about baseball, it would most certainly teach you a lot about it. There was even something on the game called Coach Mode, where you could literally just turn it on, and it would play a game, and it would be almost as if you were listening to it on the radio.
Wow. I'm looking at a picture of this now. It's like a plastic, like a big baseball stadium. This would have blown my mind as a child, with all the cartridges you're describing and all the elements that would have been right up my alley. I wanted to ask, what handheld consoles were the hardest to find information about? What's the most obscure game from that era that you've gotten to research for the compendium?
You know, there's a few. There is a game that was produced by a company called Amico, and it's called Amico Electronic Baseball. At the time that the game was produced, Amico, and I think it's pronounced Kidda, is the company. They still might even make smoke alarms at this point. But I think that they used the same technology for the sounds from a smoke alarm for this game. And the game also didn't keep score, but it came with these little plastic figures that you would stick on top of the game. And essentially all you did is you'd press the button, you would let the button go, it would make this screeching noise. It would tell you what you got, whether it was a single, a double, a home run, or an out. Then you'd press the button again to shut it up. So I bet that because of the way this game operated, people hated it. Nobody bought it. And I'm sure once you got this, whoever got this, you know, as a birthday gift or whatever, probably threw it out immediately after trying to. And that game, I think, at least as far as my experience, I've literally only come across a couple copies, and I think I might have one of two boxed copies that I've ever seen. So I think the Amico Electronic Baseball might be the most obscure, only because it was complete trash.
Some things are obscure for a reason, I guess we can say. I remember picking a game up like that, one of these like handheld games, at a garage sale and just being so excited. It was obviously like dated at the time when I got it, but I was so young. I didn't have a lot of money that I could afford to buy. It was this huge thrill. I brought it in the car. left it in the car. It baked in the sun, and it never worked again. Well, as time goes on, the action moves away from handhelds. The games move on to consoles. They get deeper, more elements and details. Obviously, the graphics get better. Real teams and players and broadcasters get involved in a more direct way. And Derek, you referenced this during a Saber presentation I watched, but does it ever just, in general, does it ever just blow your mind to think how it used to be a technological marvel to get nine figures on the screen? And now in MLB The Show, you can, as a minor league player, have a conversation with your agent that has dialogue options.
Yes, it definitely is, you know, it's quite crazy to me how far we've come in a relative short period of time, right? But even back in the day, the game that blew my mind was Earl Weaver Baseball. Now, that came out for several systems, but my favorite edition is for the Amiga computers. So Earl Weaver Baseball, and the reason I bring this one up, and it's one of my favorite games ever. Prior to that, there were computer sims that were either text-based or they had pretty generic-looking graphics. All of the animation was, there were like a handful of canned plays. So after the first few innings, if you saw a fly ball to the outfield, you knew it was going to be caught or not. So Amiga Baseball introduced physics-based gaming. So all of the hits were affected by the wind and whether it was a, you know, grass or turf or, you know, all of these different elements. Never two balls hit were never, you know, landing in the same spot. The graphics and sounds were light years ahead of games that had come out just a year or two prior. And it actually had speech capabilities where you could adjust the pronunciations of the players' names. You could create your own players. You could create your own ballparks. And this is 1986, 87 time frame. So pretty incredible for, you know, that time period. And I had had the Apple II version, which graphically was pretty crude. You know, I think you could get like four colors on the screen, maybe six. And I saw the Amiga version at my friend's house, and I was just blown away by it. So that would be, it's still one of my favorite games ever. I actually have an Amiga just for that game.
I mean, it doesn't, like, when you're a kid and you play a game like that, that absolutely just, it just checks every box you have. I mean, that just lives in your head forever. I know I definitely played games like that too. And like the handhelds, there was initially some variation among baseball video games when they started coming out in cartridge formats and for consoles. And instead of like today, where it really is just, you know, kind of the one mainstream game is released annually in MLB The Show. What was the strangest or more unique detail that a baseball video game from the earlier days had, like a quirk in the gameplay or an artistic decision, like the famous floating catcher's mitt from the original Bases Loaded, where the catcher's mitt would just catch an outside pitch, you know, 3 feet out of the zone without the catcher moving at all or even having an arm?
Yeah, that was definitely interesting. One of the ones I'm thinking of that I didn't play back then, but I have seen it, and it actually was pretty highly ranked by the survey that we did was called Base Wars, and it's actual, it's like robots. I don't know, it's like the year 2020, and you know, but back then it came out in like 1990 or somewhere around there. So they were like robots, and robots playing baseball was pretty odd concept. Yeah, I can't think of any others off the top of my head, but that was definitely an oddball, melding of, you know, sci-fi and sports.
I feel like that was a weird little sub genre where they were like, we want to do baseball, but we want to do it in like a crazy futuristic way. Cause I remember there was at least a couple of games like that, which is darkly comic when you think like, oh boy, what they actually should have done if they were saying a baseball game was taking place in 2020 was make the stadiums empty and the crowd noise piped in artificially. Little did they know it was not going to be robots. It was going to be far less interesting. What do you feel involved more innovation, the technological leaps that were made over time or like the early days when developers were just trying to portray this sport accurately using lights and sounds?
I would say each innovation, you know, is, you know, on its own interesting to me. It's just kind of the progression, right? So if you look at, John mentioned home run for the Atari 2600. A few years later, I refer to home run as stickball because there's what, three players in the field, a pitcher and a batter, right? The Intellivision game, you know, then there were 9 players in the field there. You know, and then you fast forward a few more years after that, there's like, you know, television, you know, panning and zooming and camera angles and all sorts of stuff. So it almost seems like every 5 years you could see just the amount of innovation. Some of it's just, you know, additional memory, better, you know, better sound chips, more processing power and so forth. So I just kind of look at it like it's really an interesting progression, you know, every so many years, you know, what the new changes are.
You know, it probably depends on what kind of experience the player is looking for, but obviously they've gone to much greater levels of detail and more modern versions of baseball video games. And do either of you still have any interest in playing like the new games that come out, or is it kind of like you put this collection together because that's pretty much where your interest lies, and you know, the more modern games have kind of left a lot of the stuff from these more retro games behind?
I'd say at least as far as console games, you know, my kids who are now 23 and 22 grew up playing on Wii, Xbox, whatever systems they had at the time. And I just felt like a dinosaur trying to play those baseball games. There's, I don't know, 100 different buttons on the controllers. You're able to control so many things. And I'm literally used to, you know, a joystick with a handful of buttons. I mean, the Super Nintendo with all of its buttons, I think, got too complicated when I tried to play RBI Baseball on the SNES as opposed to the NES. So I would try it. And for the most part, I was happy just watching them play and marveling at how they could control all of those things at one time.
Yeah, and the things you can get players to do, and the differences, because I know you were talking about how like in some of these games, hitting the ball in a particular way meant a certain thing was going to happen, and just the variations are available now. It's just it's overwhelming in some capacities.
I know my reflexes are nowhere near where they used to be, and I was never that great at the arcade style baseball to begin with. But even back when I started following baseball, I was more interested in the manager or general managerial aspects of the game, and, you know, putting creating different teams, you know, making mashups of like, you know, the franchise all-stars for every team, or, you know, all sorts of different things like that. So the arcade games, you know, I'll occasionally play MLB The Show, but they don't have that much of an appeal to me.
It's interesting. I mean, obviously, like I'm saying, MLB The Show kind of runs the table, but that they used to incorporate managers a little more, where in even like the title where you were talking about Earl Weaver baseball, there's like Tony La Russa had a baseball game at one point. Like the managers themselves and the managerial aspects were definitely, I think would you agree that they kind of identified that as an aspect of playing baseball games, that some kids would prefer to play it that way? So some games were kind of tailored more for that experience.
I would agree, but both of the Earl Weaver series and the Tony La Russa series did have did allow you to either manage, play and manage, or just strictly arcade style, I guess trying to cater to everyone.
Well, the collection is called Hardball Retro's Compendium of Baseball Video Games and Electronic Handhelds by Derek Bain and John Racanelli. Guys, thanks for joining us on Hittin' Season. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. Thanks again to my co-host, Liz Rocher, and all of our guests. For more episodes of Hittin' Season every week, go to billypenn.com/hittin'season or anywhere you get your podcasts. For bonus Phillies podcasts, check out the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks for listening, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.